summary of the news. David Cameron is to use a speech tomorrow to harden his stance on immigration, promising that migrants won't be considered for social housing in England until they've spent at least 2 years in the country. Local authorities will have to introduce minimum residency times of between 2 and 5 years for joining waiting lists. The President of Cyprus is in Brussels to try to finalise an international bailout plan intended to save his country from going bankrupt. A spokesman for the Cypriot government said he had a very difficult task ahead of him. Nikos Anastasiadis will have to explain how he'll raise 5.8 billion euros by tomorrow. After meeting EU officials, he'll hold talks with the heads of the International Monetary Fund and European Central Bank. Police investigating the death of the Russian tycoon Boris Berezovsky have given his home the all-clear following tests for nuclear, chemical and biological substances. His body was found at the mansion in Berkshire yesterday. The cause of his death is not known, but friends have said he was feeling depressed. Severe weather's continuing to cause disruption across the UK, with thousands of homes still without power in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. One of the worst affected areas is the Isle of Arran, which has been without mains electricity since Friday morning. The M1 is closed in both directions near Coventry. East Midlands Airport was closed all morning but has just reopened. Pope Francis has celebrated his first Palm Sunday Mass in St Peter's Square. During the service, he announced that he would travel to Brazil to attend a Catholic youth festival in Rio de Janeiro in July. Sebastian Vettel of Red Bull has won the Malaysian Grand Prix. His teammate Mark Webber came second and Lewis Hamilton took third place for Mercedes. And let's look at the weather again. There'll be more snow, mainly across Northern Ireland, Wales and parts of Western and Central England. The snow will gradually ease, although there'll be some showers in northeast England. It'll continue to be bitterly cold and windy. Tonight will be largely dry, with patchy snow and a hard frost. BBC News and weather at 1:02. And now time for the early music show. And today, Lucy Skeeping looks at the splendour of Baroque architecture and stage design.
If you follow the Vltava River south from Prague towards its headquarters not far from the Czech border with Austria, you reach Český Krumlov in southern Bohemia. Český is the site of one of Europe's great medieval castles, and it looms forbiddingly over the narrowing river. It's not one of those great stone crenellated fortifications, though, like Prague Castle or, say, Dublin Castle. Český is more like a city, 30 or 40 buildings and a series of courtyards put up over several centuries, and they're all decorated with the most amazing trompe d'oeil. And in the fifth courtyard stands was perhaps the jewel of the entire complex and what we've come to see today, Český Krumlov's amazing Baroque theatre. Like so much else in this part of the world, it's a product of Habsburg times, of the German-speaking princes who for three centuries, up until the First World War in fact, ruled what we now think of as the Czech Republic. The first theatre was built in the 1680s by Prince Johann Christian von Eggenberg. His domains extended down into the Veneto, and we find him making a number of visits to Venice, in particular frequenting the relatively new entertainment of opera that was flourishing there. Evidently made a deep impression, and so back home here at Český Castle, he employed Italian architects to oversee the building work of his own theatre, and there was soon a highly competent company of actors and musicians in residence, and a library stocked with the best literature and drama from throughout Europe. But it wasn't until nearly a century later, in the 1770s and 80s, that the theatre really achieved its true glory. Prince Joseph Adam von Schwarzenberg now had the entire place renovated, or reconstructed, you could say, and for 20 years, the theatre, complete with sophisticated systems of ropes and pulleys and movable footlights, the very latest scene-changing technology, resonated to the sights and sounds of Italian opera seria and opera buffa, French opera and opera comique, and German singspiel, as well as a potpourri of danced and dramatised variations on the ancient myths. Well, there's going to be a lot to see, and so I've brought along with me the theatre historian Ian McIntosh, who's promised to take us into some of the backstage areas that are usually out of bounds. Well, it's pretty cold up here. There's snow on the ground below, and although I've got my thermals on, I think we ought to go inside to follow in the footsteps of the princes, the wealthy merchants, and the townspeople who flocked here for opera performances. Mind you, it wasn't just a musical experience for them. It was a visual feast as well, which began just as soon as they stepped into the salon. Well, Ian, we're in the most amazing room. It's painted. We've got five glorious chandeliers. What would have happened in here?
This is where the prince would welcome his guests. He would have come from the far end of the castle. There are three floors in the castle, all richly decorated. But this one is unique. It's 1766, and it's decorated totally in flat painting. When you go into a Baroque room like this of the late 18th century, in most castles in Europe, there's plaster work. It's full of mouldings. This is actually all flat painting. And the flat painting is very musical. There are collections of musical instruments. I mean, any historian can see exactly what an early music clarinet was like, what the string instruments were like, wonderful cellos and violas. And the acoustics were perfect because they're flat walls with three windows on one side, mirrors on the other side, and a slight cove between the wall and the ceiling. The plasterwork brought in a regular curve, and the whole thing is a unit. And the whole thing was painted by the same people who painted the scenery in the theatre.
It has the feel of a kind of reception area. Almost when you arrive, perhaps you might come in and admire your friends' dresses, meet and greet old friends, and perhaps, presumably, wait until the royals arrive to signal you into the auditorium.
Indeed, but you might also come here for a concert. This was used for string quartets, and the prince would entertain his guests with music here. And it's not just a vestibule. It is an end in itself. And it is beautifully maintained. It's hardly been touched. They've patched a few places, but we're looking at 1766 flat painting.
Although, as you say, it's all trompe d'oeil and flat, the decoration with its pastels and its little roses sprinkled about everywhere, it feels rather French. Would I be right about that?
I don't think so. I think we're now under the influence of Vienna. And if you go to the palaces like the Schönberg in Vienna, you'll see the same as this, but to a much richer degree in terms of the plasterwork. This is done in an old medieval castle, and yet we feel if we're in a pure rectangular room, because it didn't matter if the walls weren't parallel, because the painter made it look as if the walls were parallel. And that is the cleverness of the whole of this castle, that it's a continuity from medieval times through the Renaissance to the 18th century, and each room has the feeling of its own period. But Vienna in 1760 was very different from Versailles in 1760. The chandeliers are all low, and that's terribly important. They're still candle chandeliers. Nobody's electrified them. So for the great evenings now, today, they light the candles. Because the chandeliers are low, they light the ladies' faces, they light the costumes, and they, the people, become the actors in this room.
Well, it's incredibly breathtaking. It must have been the most wonderful start to an evening to come in here. We've left the Salon of Mirrors, and still on our way into the auditorium of the theatre, we're now passing through another very large salon. This is the Maskensaal, or Hall of Masks. And Ian, it's pretty obvious why it's called that, isn't it?
Yes, and we've also gone back 20 years. This is the work of one artist, Joseph Lederer, in 1748. And it is said that he locked the doors and let nobody in except his assistant. In 3 months, he painted this entire room, and it is unique in the whole of the world, because here we meet not only the performers, the Commedia dell'arte performers, but also the audience. And so we can see in this large space, in 20 panels, what this audience looked like and what the performers looked like. We meet the musicians, because this was mainly a dancing space. So as in Vienna, the musicians were up in a gallery, and there on the wall in trompe d'oeil are their instruments hanging on pegs, the coats that they brought in, and on every side we have the harlequinade, and even in one window we have the poor people looking in at a painted arch. And they're very happy, poor people, because the prince welcome his entire citizens into the theatre. And in one place, he actually paints a reflection on the glass of a little boy, a Turkish boy, because we're at a period when people are obsessed with Turkey and the Orient and Africa. So they all appear in a very friendly way. Everybody in this room is happy.
Lively, you know, although we're here alone, standing in the middle of the dance floor, you feel there are just people all around you. They're moving, they're dancing, they're masquerading. There's a harlequin over there with a kind of like a baseball bat behind his back, and he's just about to do something terrible. And there's somebody hopping over a wall. I mean, it's full of life. It's big pantomime, isn't it?
And there's a Turk smoking a 6-foot-long pipe in a turban with a large beard. And round here, there's a harlequin that is back to us in the full harlequin's costume. This is actually very important for research of the period, because we now know here, better than from the little china figures, exactly what each character looked like. And the people of the court and of the town have dressed up for the occasion, so we're seeing what you wore for a masquerade.
This room's got much more of a sort of orangey yellow feel. The previous room was more of a pink pastel feel. But the thing that really strikes me is this tableau at one end above a very pretty mirror, which is another kind of gallery, but not a minstrel's gallery. What would have gone on up there?
I think people who wanted to observe the whole affair, younger members of the family perhaps, they would be able to reach that by a passage, see everybody down here. Not all that easily, because we've got these very low chandeliers. We've got 12 chandeliers here, plus the wall fittings, 114 candles. I've seen them all lit here. It is an extraordinary effect, because it brings the characters to life. The flickering light on these characters gives the face and the expression a marvellous feeling of happiness.
Everything here at the Chetsky Krumlov Theatre seems to have been arranged for comfort. Leaving the Painted Hall of Masks, the noble party would walk right through this narrow corridor. Painted, of course. It's about 5 stories up with the most fabulous views of the town either side, which leads to the auditorium. In fact, to the back of the Prince's box itself, which we're just going into now. Ian, what an amazing sight. It's absolutely spectacular. This is really rather like being on the inside of one of those little toy theatres. Now, in front of us, there's one of those disappearing stage sets, a kind of fake perspective, making the stage seem, of course, much deeper than it really is. But I suppose if you were part of the Prince's party coming into the royal box here, you wouldn't have been greeted by a stage looking like this. There would have been a curtain down.
There was a painted front cloth, painted in the same style as this wonderful ceiling, which is full of people from classical legend. And the walls, however, were more in the style of the rest of the palace, and the whole painted by the Viennese artists Vetchel and Merkel, who painted all the scenery as well. Now, we're looking at a asymmetric set of the garden with, at the end, a sea and a boat. Now, that sea waved in a remarkable device by moving handles underneath the waves, and the ship tossed its way across that sea by asymmetric wheels underneath. So it bobbed up and down to the great pleasure of the audience. And at the end of that scene, in no more than 8 to 10 seconds, the entire scenery would change. This means that the 5 pairs of wings would go outwards, revealing behind 5 pairs of wings for another scene. Each of these pairs of wings were on chariots, and you could pre-rig 3 different sets for the evening's opera or play. Some of these sets were very deep and went right to the back wall of the theatre. Others would use just 3 portals so that behind the back cloth, which came in halfway upstage, you could prepare the special effects for the next scene. And the museum is full of those special effects.
Must have been quite an army of people working it all, because the effect to the audience was like magic, but of course it was all hard graft going on behind the scenes.
Probably about 35 people, and that is more than the orchestra of 18 or 19 and the performers maybe a dozen. So the machinists were, in a sense, the principals of this particular theatre. Not only were the wings changing, but the borders, the sky was changing. And the remarkable thing about this theatre, there's nowhere to take the backcloth or the wings up out of sight. Each one had to be rigged with little rings on behind and cords that reefed them upwards. And so not only do we have a single shaft under the centre of the stage with great capstans, which they turned so that all wings moved simultaneously, but also there were further capstans up in the fly galleries above the stage which moved all the borders at the same time.
And then there were the trap doors. People would appear out of the floor and go down that way, I suppose, in a sense of symbolising hell or something.
Symbolising hell. We're from a period, Shakespeare, the same period, where the world is divided into 3 parts. The hell, the earth where we exist, together with the actors, and the heavens from which the gods appear. That runs through all dramatic literature, from the Renaissance right through into the 18th century.
thing that really strikes me is that the style of the painting, the decoration in the auditorium, this 3D effect with the clusters of musical instruments, with the beautiful little garlands of roses and so on. In a sense, the style continues onto the stage. The scenery flats, the side wings, are very much the same kind of classical style, although, of course, they're jigsawed out to make the actual trees and so on.
Well, the influence is Viennese. While the Eggenbergs, who were here in the 17th century, their influence was Italian, and the preceding theatre, which was opened in 1680, was made entirely of timber. The scenery would not have looked like this. This is the scenery of Vienna that lasted throughout the 18th century. And I would say that you can't understand the magic flute until you see a theatre like this, because while Mozart's other operas were written for a variety of theatres, the Magic Flute was written for Schikaneder, and Schikaneder's theatre would have had all this machinery, and the audience would feel cheated if they didn't see it in action. So think of the Magic Flute and think of what happens as you go through the tests and meet the mysterious world.
Dann sperrte ich sie bei mir ein und alle Mädchen wären mein. Wenn alle Mädchen wären mein, so tauschte ich nach Zucker an die, welche mir am liebsten wär. Er gäb ich gleich den Zucker her und küsste sie mit zärtlich, dann wär sie mein Weib und ich ihr Mann. Sie schlief an meiner Seite ein, ich wehte wie ein Küsschen ein.
Well, we're now on the stage, which is rather exciting. I feel like reciting some great soliloquy, but I'm going to refrain from it because we're having a really close look now at some of these side scenery flats. And they're not quite so precise and sort of clear when you get close, like so much on the stage. There's a couple of cherubs holding a fish which is spouting water, some pillars there, a Venus holding some garlands. It's all very classical, but most fascinating is what we see straight ahead, which we touched on before, which is this sea. And as you get closer, you realise that the waves are made of cloth, and inside them are these wooden wheel things, and people would turn them either side, and they start rippling. It's incredible. They're like the tummy of a belly dancer, I think. If we're very lucky, we might just hear them now.
And these were not the only effects with which the musicians had to compete. There were thunder runs, which involved running a cannonball down a piece of timber above us here. In some theatres, it was over the auditorium. There are wind machines and there are rain machines. And they're all kept here in the museum.
Well, it's all so realistic. I'm feeling almost seasick. I think we ought to go and have a look at that museum. Well, we've climbed up several staircases of wooden steps and we're off in the museum high above what would be the fly tower if there was one. And there are just so many riches, from original costumes and props to scaled down models of the sets and, of course, painted flats. This isn't so much a public exhibition, though, is it, than a sort of centre of study for historic theatre conferences and, of course, conservation research and so on, all very, very important.
It's also a shrine to Prince Joseph Adam Schwarzenberg, who was the great patron of the 18th century theatre. We're standing in front of an oval portrait of him in the most ornate Baroque frame I've ever seen. It has 12 candles on it, and it is here because he had the theatre built for his son's wedding in 1768, when the whole of the town became a theatre. And in the opera house, he commissioned an opera from Giuseppe Scarlatti, Dove è amore e geliosa, Where there is love, there is jealousy. This was commissioned for a princely wedding, so they weren't short on irony.
Well, you mentioned, Ian, about the candles on the frame just now, and of course the whole place was lit by candles. God knows about the fire hazard. But one of the most amazing things is the way they did use this candlelight. And in front of us are some little bushes, flat bushes of scenery.
They're vines.
Oh, they're little grapevines, are they?
And the bunches of grapes are lit from behind with candles. And there are trees where the oranges are lit from behind by candles. Why? Because gardens were often magic in these operas. So you would have magical trees and magical grapes. And behind them is this wonderful backcloth. We're looking at an original now. It's really superb. And it's just a woodland scene. The feathery trees are beautifully painted and remind me actually of Gainsborough. Gainsborough and Hayman in the 18th century in England started their lives as scene painters. And when you look at this backcloth, you're looking really at the background to a Gainsborough figure. And when you next look at Gainsborough portraits en plein air, look at the trees behind and you can see a scene painter at work.
We've come to a small part of the museum where there are four large glass cases containing what I guess are the most valuable costumes in the collection. Tell us what's in this first one.
Well, the first thing to notice is they're all for very small people, because people were smaller then, and a modern performer couldn't wear them. The first one is a female, extraordinary Baroque warrior. So she's wearing a breastplate and a great skirt. So this is how the warriors of mythology were presented on stage.
The work, the gold thread, the satin, the velvet. I mean, these costumes are so richly decorated. I would have thought the prince would look shabby in comparison.
Well, if we walk to the next case, we will see princely costumes. You're absolutely right. They are more elaborate. Now, you think that in Shakespeare's time they couldn't afford elaborate costumes, so they picked up second-hand costumes from princely people in the Elizabethan period. You feel it possibly was the reverse here. The prince wouldn't like to wear costumes like these because it's heightened majesty. And that's what you get in so many of these operas, heightened majesty. And here we have the whole kit for Mercury. The winged helmet, the bow and arrow, and the caduceus with the serpent spining up to an eagle at the top. So he was a character that appeared in many of the operas.
Would they have employed people sitting here on a full-time basis, sewing, mending, and, of course, actually creating these props?
Yes, so there was a very large staff. The actors and the singers were on full-time contracts, and so were the musicians, and so were the staff. They would have spent possibly the whole year preparing costumes for operas. Of course, these were not for individual operas. These were always stock costumes that you brought out for an opera. You can almost dress any opera from the wardrobe.
One of the things that always amuses me is the fact that they seem to use the sets, the scenery flats, again and again. It didn't really matter which performance it was in.
This was universal, the same in England. Very rarely were things made for a particular opera. What was made for a particular opera would be a machine that did something special, that brought somebody from the heavens or brought a monster from the deep. Yes, you would make those specially, but generally you had, of the 12 sets here, you had the ballroom, you had the garden, you had the seaside, you had the imperial camp, you had a prison. All were stock scenes, and they were most of them painted within a very short period, within the first 5 years of the theatre. They set themselves up with this fantastic collection of scenery, which is the best in Europe.
Thank you.
Here's a rail of costumes that actually belong to the musicians. This is what the real musicians in the 18th century wore in the pit. It made the most exquisite linen. I hardly dare touch them because they've lasted so long. Even the sweat from my hand apparently could spoil this linen. It's a salmon colour, although perhaps it was a little redder a couple of hundred years ago. Who knows? Breeches, of course. A little frock coat with the most pretty cream lace and gold thread down the front to die for here. Buttons covered in, again, this gold thread. If you're lucky enough ever to come to a performance here, I believe, which happens in the summer months, the musicians, of course, that they use in the pit now wear copies of these costumes, and very, very good they are as well. But, of course, there is something very special about seeing and indeed touching the originals because they're works of art in their own right. Ian, it's been amazing to see all this. And it's not surprising that Český Krumlov is a World Heritage Site. Now, we're looking down on what I suppose you could call the castle walls, really. I mean, this is where the public came and walked along when they visited the castle, and still do, if this little crowd out here has anything to go by. And even now, this sort of outdoor path separates the new world from the old, in a sense.
The old town is perfectly preserved. The roofs are all in original terracotta.
And like the fantastic costumes and the wonderful painted sets and everything we've seen in the opera house itself, the town here is perfectly preserved.
There for the closing scene of Alessandro Scarlatti's opera L'Amor Generoso, recorded live at the Baroque Theatre of Český Krumlov in the Czech Republic in 2002. And it ends today's edition of the Early Music Show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping with Ian McIntosh and produced by Les Pratt. Well, live from Bristol tomorrow night at 7:30, soloists of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment will be performing two of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, numbers 4 and 5. That's part of the Bristol Baroque Festival. But now, as part of our Baroque Spring here on BBC Radio 3, we join Katie Derham live in Richmond.
Hello and welcome to the Long Gallery of Ham House in Richmond for the fourth in our series of Baroque Spring live Sunday afternoon concerts from National Trust properties around the UK, or the Baroque Cream Tea Tour, as I like to call it. Ham House is the most splendid building. It's a wonderful example of a Stuart house built in the reign of Charles I and beautified in glorious Baroque style in the reign of Charles II, who came here regularly to dine. And interestingly, the same family held on to Ham House during the difficult years of the Civil War. That was the wily William Murray and his doughty daughter, who became Duchess of Lauderdale and who was responsible for most of the collections here. But you'll be able to hear more about them and the house and its history in the interval when I'm taken on a voyage of exploration and discovery by the House and Collections Manager, Victoria Bradley, and by my regular guest and expert, Lars Tharp, from the Antiques Roadshow. But before then, the stage is set right in the middle of this long gallery, priceless portraits and equally priceless audience members on both sides of the musicians. And standing by, we have the Magdalena Consort, an acclaimed chamber group directed by baritone Peter Harvey. There are 4 singers and 9 instrumentalists, all of them smartly but warmly dressed for this optimistically titled spring concert. They're going to be performing a programme of music for Holy Week. It's music of the German Baroque, which means Bach, of course, but not just Johann Sebastian, but music by some of the older Bachs too, and by other musicians and composers who influenced the great J.S. We're going to start with work by Johann Scheller, one of J.S. Bach's predecessors at the Thomaskirche in Leipzig. His cantatas were widely famed. No visitor to Leipzig in the last 2 decades of the 17th century would have missed a Sunday performance. Apparently, listeners flew in like bees for the sweet honey of Scheller's church music. Well, we're going to hear words from the penitential Psalm 130. Aus der Tiefen rufe ich her. Out of the deep I call you, Lord. Here is the Magdalena Concert, directed by Peter Harvey.
Aus der Tiefen rufe ich her. Gottes Herr. Meine Seele harret und ich hoffe. Ich hoffe, ich hoffe, ich hoffe auf sein Wort. Meine Seele harret und ich hoffe. Ich hoffe, ich hoffe, ich hoffe auf sein Wort. Meine Seele harret und ich hoffe. Ich hoffe, ich hoffe, ich hoffe auf sein Wort. Ich hoffe auf sein Wort.
Ich harre dein und deiner Güte, die mir dein heiliges Wort verspricht. Du wirst ja mein zerknirschtes
aus allen Teilen.
Johann Schiller's setting of the words of Psalm 130, Aus der tiefen rufe ich her, out of the deep I call you Lord. And we're going to hear Johann Sebastian Bach's setting of those words at the end of this afternoon's concert. Next, a work by Johann Michael Bach. Now, Johann Michael was a cousin of Johann Sebastian's father and was actually Johann Sebastian's father-in-law as well. Johann Michael died young at just 46 years old, and he left four unmarried daughters, and one of them was Maria Barbara, who Johann Sebastian married in 1707. But before it all gets a bit too confusing, let me leave the genealogy. Johann Michael, like all the Bachs, was a very fine musician. Relatively little of his work remains. We're going to hear a piece now, though, called Auf, lasst uns den Herren loben. Then let us praise the Lord, which is based on an anonymous poem and is intended for the new year. But its message, which is in prayer for the coming year, and the last verse, which leads the believer towards the hope of a blessed death, makes it a suitable Easter week hymn.